But he had this total take it or leave it attitude towards what was going on, no matter how successful he was.
When he played, it changed the complexion of the band. It livened it up, and it was more modern. He was that much of an influence.
As I hear it, rates, along with Goodman and Pee Wee Russell and one or two others, as the truly important clarinetists of any age.
He was one of the most admired clarinetists of the 20th century, matching stunning technique to a sound that was indescribably beautiful. His big bands and small groups were among the best and most innovative of their time. He even became a media idol who starred in movies and married glamorous actresses like Lana Turner and Ava Gardner. But for all his success, he remained restless and dissatisfied. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, we remember the brilliant and always outspoken NEA jazz master, Artie Shaw. Each year, the National Endowment for the Arts names 6 to 7 jazz masters, living musicians whose careers have changed the course of jazz. It's the highest honor for jazz given in the United States. In December 2004, Artie Shaw was delighted to hear that he'd been named a 2005 jazz master. Just days before he was to appear at the NEA Awards ceremony, Artie Shaw passed away at the age of 94. Today on Jazz Profiles, the story of Artie Shaw.
I was scheduled to do a program, my first appearance in New York City, with my own band. And I had no theme song, I had no idea that I was supposed to have one.
Artie Shaw.
I was told about 2 hours before we were on the air, or a day before rather, that we were going to need a theme song. Since I had an altogether different band at that time from what was currently being used, I had to write something that the strings could play. So in those days, not knowing a hell of a lot about the range and capabilities of a string section, I wrote that sort of droning pedal point with the ascending and descending, fourth and fifth, and improvised over it, figuring that when we went on the air, I'd look at my stopwatch and see how long I'd keep improvising in order to fill up the ending of the broadcast. And before we went on the air, somebody came in and said, "What's the name of your theme song?" And I had no name for it, so I called it Nightmare. People think of it as ominous, but it wasn't meant to be that. It came through, I guess. Maybe it was a foretaste in my mind, without knowing, a premonition of what I was getting into.
Arthur Jacob Arshawsky was born on May 23, 1910, to poor Jewish immigrants. When he was 7, the family moved from New York City's Lower East Side to New Haven, Connecticut. Shaw was an eager learner and an avid reader, but being wrapped up in his books didn't take away from the harsh reality of immigrant life. Trumpeter and author Richard Sudhalter.
His father was what has always been called in both German and Yiddish, a Luftmensch, a man of little substance, who worked here, worked there, and disappeared from Artie's life at a very early age. He encountered him later, as he's written about. But basically, he was on his own with his mother in this strange community in New Haven. So it seems to me that the logical thing to do would have been to turn inward and to simply improve the mind. And of course, as we know from numerous accounts, both Artie's own and many others, his hunger for learning was limitless, as it very often is in the case of the autodidact, the person who has to kind of pick it up as he goes along.
Artie Shaw.
I was a victim of anti-Semitism to a terrible degree, and I had to get out of that environment and get into something that made sense. Otherwise, I'd have wound up like a friend of mine I grew up with who died in the electric chair. I'd have been a criminal. I have great sympathy for rebels, because I was one. Fortunately, my implement was, instead of a machine gun, I became a saxophonist. I saw this guy get up and play a saxophone, and I thought, boy, that sounds nice. Look at the pretty girls and the lights, and that's nice, vaudeville. So I got a saxophone.
He got his saxophone when he was 14, and months later picked up the clarinet. At 15, Arthur Arshalski, now calling himself Art Shaw, left home to become a professional musician. He listened to saxophonist Frank Trumbauer, Bix Beiderbecke on cornet, and eventually discovered Louis Armstrong.
I was a white man, and Bix was white, so I didn't have much access to what we then called colored music. So Bix and Trumbauer, his sidekick, were my first two musical influences, real influences. Before that, anybody that came along that could play a C scale was an influence. But I heard these two guys and I realized they were doing something different. They had a different sound. People underestimate the value of sound. What you sound like is your imprint, your thumbprint. And so when I first heard both of those guys, I thought they're the ones. And I followed everything they did. I listened to them. Until the day I happened to run into a record called Savoy Blues by Louis Armstrong. And then I decided that was altogether different, a different feeling, a different approach. I didn't realize I was in black and white music. I didn't think about it in those terms. Louis sounded different. And I listened to things like West End Blues. As a matter of fact, it was the first thing I ever heard him play live. I couldn't get over it. Nobody played a trumpet like that before. He became my idol. And if I was influenced by anyone, it would be Armstrong.
In 1930, Artie Shaw arrived in New York City with a band known as Irving Aronson's Commanders. Later, he began sitting in with the great Harlem pianist Willie the Lion Smith.
Playing with Willie Lion night after night was a big influence in the sense that I had never heard his kind of playing before. It wasn't what we now think of as jazz piano in the sense of, say, McCoy Tyner or Brad Meldow or any of the present guys. Willie had a stride piano sound, and he played a little bit like a ragtime, but not quite. He was a bridge between James P. Johnson and what we now call jazz music. The riffs that he played that were very, very different. He would change keys in the middle of the thing and bring it back into the key at the very end.
Shaw soon became the top sideman for live radio and studio recordings, where he played lead alto sax and clarinet. One of his first jazz record dates was led by trumpeter Wingy Manon. Easy Like, recorded in August of 1934, and featuring Dickie Wells on trombone, Bud Freeman on tenor saxophone, Teddy Wilson at the piano, and Artie Shaw. On May 24, 1936, less than a year after the music, now called swing, had burst into mass popularity, Shaw appeared in a swing music concert at New York's Imperial Theater. It was a performance that changed his life forever. Artie Shaw.
I was supposed to play a 3-minute piece while the big bands were being changed behind the scenes, the setups were being changed. So I decided, instead of appearing with a rhythm section, I decided I would try something for kicks for myself. No idea that anybody even listened to it. But I wrote for a string quartet and clarinet and a very small rhythm section, leaving out piano. Well, to our astonishment, it busted up the show.
Interlude in B-flat, the piece that catapulted Artie Shaw into the spotlight. 2 weeks later, Shaw was in a recording studio with an orchestra for the first time as a leader. The 1936 Artie Shaw Orchestra featured a string quartet along with a few horns and a rhythm section. Although musicians loved it, the band could not make enough sound to compete with the larger and louder swing bands.
And so I got together what I've since called the loudest goddamn band in the world. That's what they wanted, noise. I got them a noisy band. But still, I tried to play music. Still, I decided we would play the best music, which meant anywhere from Sigmund Romberg on up through Jerome Kern and Cole Porter and whatever. And I figured that was going to be the identity of the band.
For the next 18 months, the Shaw Band developed a unique musical identity and built a huge following. In 1938, Artie signed with RCA Bluebird. His first recording date with his new label yielded one of his signature hits.
Everybody in the studio connected with that record date, especially a guy named Eli Oberstein, who was there, the equivalent of what we would call today an A&R man. He wanted me to do something with Indian Love Call because it was a big hit. So I thought, okay, we'd do that for our first date. But in it, the band didn't do much, and I decided I would do something as a quiet other side, a B-side. So we made Indian Love Call the A-side, figuring that was the hit. And B was the accompanying, sort of nice little tune. But that was the one that stepped out and became something. Being the Beguine became the big hit. One of the biggest instrumental hits ever recorded.
Begin the Begin, composed by Cole Porter and arranged by Jerry Gray. Recorded by Artie Shaw and his orchestra in July of 1938 for RCA Bluebird. Coming up on the program, Artie Shaw takes a risk and crosses the color line. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, we're telling the story of the late NEA jazz master, Artie Shaw. You can find us on the web at npr.org and on the air from NPR, National Public Radio. Welcome back to NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson, with more on the late NEA jazz master, Artie Shaw. At that same 1938 recording session that produced Begin the Begin, the Artie Shaw Band recorded a song that the bandleader had written for the band's vocalist, a young woman named Billie Holiday.
Any old time you want me, I am yours. For just the asking, darling, any old time you need me, I'll be there. With love that's lasting, darling, all through the years we'll stand together, sharing the tears and stormy weather and the sunshine. We'll be yours and mine. Any old time you're blue, you'll have our love to chase away the blues. And any old thing you do, I'll see you through. So just remember that I am waiting, dear. If ever you want me, I'll be near. Any old time and any place where you may be.
Any Old Time turned out to be the only recording that Billie Holiday made with the Artie Shaw Orchestra. But Shaw's connection to Holiday was a milestone in America. It marked one of the first times that a black singer toured with a white band. Alto saxophonist Les Robinson played for Artie Shaw in three different groups.
We traveled around one-nighters, and I recall that in those days, especially if we played the southern cities, there was a lot of racial bigotry going on. But we traveled on a bus in those days. They wouldn't serve Billie, Lady Day, as we called her, because she was black. She would go into a restaurant and they'd say, we don't serve blacks, you know. And we'd just all walk out and thumb our noses. It was terrible. And she loved us and we loved her.
One time, the band had her paint a little dot on her forehead with lipstick. They carried her bags in and pretended that she was a princess. She was able to check into the hotel that time, but didn't like it too much. She eventually left the band because of a racist incident at a New York City hotel. The other hotel guests objected to Lady Day's presence in the elevators. Artie Shaw.
So I said, Billy, it's up to you. This is the problem. They run a hotel, and I know you're going to say, I don't give a damn, but if you could go take the freight elevator up there, they wouldn't lose business. Oh, she said, Artie, this is too much. I said, well, really, it's a matter of imposition, because I think you're accomplishing more on the bandstand, but that's up to you. I'm not going to advise you. No, she said, I think I'll go. People have been coming to me about doing a solo, single. So I said, I don't blame you. Whatever you want to do. So she gave me her notice then. Very amicable.
Artie Shaw lost Billie Holiday, but brought new energy to his band with two exciting additions, drummer Buddy Rich and tenor saxophonist Georgie Auld. By the end of 1939, Shaw had the most popular band in America. Author Burt Carroll.
He went for simplicity, and he went for a very specific sort of sound, yet the music was very danceable. And all the guys in the band had great respect for him and for the kind of music they were playing. Buddy had a very good idea about how to lift up a band and give it a sense of inner and exterior fire. He did things in big bands, playing accents on the brass figures, playing lead-ins, and doing things like that that really no one else was doing during those years. And technically, he was a killer.
Oh, Lady Be Good by George and Ira Gershwin, recorded by Artie Shaw and his orchestra in August of 1939. Despite his newfound commercial success, Artie Shaw detested the demands made on him by the public.
I was interested in the music, and it was always at loggerheads with the public and the bookers and the owners of the theaters. I never could get together with those people. You'd play a theater, you couldn't change a tune, so 7-8 times a day, for months at a time, we were playing the same bloody pieces.
Les Robinson.
One night, he just said, goodbye. I'm out of here. That's when he took off, went to Mexico, and it was the end of the world because the band was so high. We were now suddenly number one. We were rated by all the polls and whatever in those days, the music magazine, suddenly number one. He had all these great contracts coming up. My God, he had bookings that, you know, money-wise. And to walk away from that?
Richard Sudhalter.
By that time, just being a star band leader with a hit record was starting to get on its nerves because the people wanted to hear what they knew, Begin the Beguine and whatever else. And I think things reached critical mass toward the end of 1939 when he did something that no other band leader in history that I know of ever did. He just walked off the stand, said, sorry guys, I've had it, got into his car, and drove to Mexico. It's interesting that while he was in Mexico, his musical ears remained open.
When I was in Mexico and heard Frenesi, I didn't decide to record it. It was what I thought was a mariachi tune. So I was staying at this hotel. It was right over the place, the cliff where they dive into the water. And I used to hear this tune every night. I had a broken leg at that time. And I came back to L.A. to get the leg mended. And I had a recording date. So I went to the recording studio and we made two Mexican tunes. I didn't know they were even copyright. I didn't know that. I thought they were folk songs. So I made Frenesi among them. Adios Mariquita Linda was the other. And Frenesi took off. And to nobody's great surprise, except mine, it became a huge hit. ¶¶
Frenesy, composed by Alberto Dominguez and arranged by William Grant Still and Artie Shaw. It was from an L.A. recording date in March of 1940. It's the late NEA jazz master Artie Shaw on this edition of Jazz Profiles. Welcome back to NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson, with more on the story of clarinetist and bandleader Artie Shaw. In the summer of 1940, the ever-restless Shaw put together a new touring orchestra that included a string section. It also featured star soloists like Billy Butterfield on trumpet and Jack Jenny on trombone. That fall, Shaw's new orchestra recorded their own take on the perennial hit Stardust.
Written from a sketch I gave Lenny Hayton, and the chorus itself said ad lib, solo ad lib. So whatever we did was spontaneous.
Artie Shaw.
It happened that the first take was a very good one. As I remember it, we did it in one take. At the end of the take, I said, well, might as well go home. It isn't going to get any better than that. So we left.
Trumpeter and author Richard Sudhalter.
The centerpiece of the record is, of course, the half chorus that Shaw plays in mid-record. That half chorus solo is a composition. It's not just a solo on Stardust. Listen to its first four bars. Those interlocked phrases are like something out of Bix Beiderbecke.
Alto saxophonist Les Robinson.
That is, to me, will always be the definitive recording of Stardust, mainly because of Billy and Jack Jenny's gorgeous trombones, and of course the great Artie Shaw rendition of a clarinet solo that no one can ever top. But it was a hell of a band. It was a band that had everything. Tommy Dorsey said it sounded just like a great, magnificent pipe organ.
Stardust, composed by Hoagy Carmichael and arranged by Lenny Hayton, recorded by Artie Shaw and his orchestra in October of 1940. Like other band leaders such as Benny Goodman, Tommy Dorsey, Duke Ellington, and Count Basie, Artie Shaw also recorded with a series of small groups. Most of them were known as the Gramercy Five. These groups enabled Artie and some of his best soloists to stretch out. One of these, Bands Within a Band, contained an instrument almost unheard of in jazz, a harpsichord, played by Johnny Guarnieri. Special Delivery Stomp, recorded by Artie Shaw and his Gramercy Five in September of 1940. Shaw disbanded his orchestra in March 1941, but that summer he formed an even more ambitious one, this time featuring an irrepressible Kansas City trumpeter, Orrin Hot Lips Page. This new ensemble contained 32 pieces, including a 15-piece string section. Author Bert Carroll.
I think he did extraordinary work with the strings band, and he set the mode for the first 5 years of the 40s, because a lot of major band leaders started adding string sections. Harry James did, Tommy Dorsey did, Krupa did.
Richard Sudhalter.
I can imagine at some point him thinking, oh, Hot Lips Page and his very strongly blues-oriented way of playing and singing is going to be a wonderful counterbalance to some of the more rarefied, if you will, concepts, including the writing of the arranger and composer Paul Jordan. So again, it's elements, it's pieces in a puzzle.
Suite number 8, composed and arranged by Paul Jordan and featuring Hot Lips Page, recorded by Artie Shaw and his orchestra in December of 1941. This largest of all Artie Shaw orchestras came to an abrupt end on December 7th, 1941.
I was in Providence. We were playing on the stage, and I went off stage to grab a smoke, and the radio was playing. And the announcer was hysterical. The Japs have bombed Pearl Harbor, blah, blah, blah. All of a sudden, the manager's on the phone. He says, go out and make an announcement. I've just been called by the War Department. All military personnel to report to the base immediately. So I went back out on stage after the dance act was over, and I made the announcement. And then after that, when I suddenly realized how many servicemen there were out there, you know, the draft had already been initiated. And, I mean, two-thirds of the theater got up and left. And I got to say, we're going to play our recording arrangement of it. Oh, geez, it sounded, Stardust sounded so fatuous after that, that I started it and let the band get going into it. And I walked up to Les Robinson right in the front line. I said, pass the word, 2 weeks' notice. Totally impulse. I knew I didn't want to go on with this anymore. So 2 weeks' notice, and I went down to the Navy, 90 Church Street, and enlisted. And that was that.
Artie Shaw went into the Navy as an enlisted man and was put in charge of a band that was not to his liking. So he went to Washington, D.C. to visit an old acquaintance, James Forrestal, the Undersecretary of State for the Navy.
I went in, And Forrester looked at me, shook his head. He said, Jesus, I knew you would be in trouble. You know, you're AWL, you know what that means? I said, sure, but you're the boss man here. What do you want, he said. I said, I just want to know what the hell I can do. I can't. This is ridiculous. They got me leading the stupidest band in the world. What do you want to do? I said, I want to get a good band together. Give me the right to get some men together. So I went around and saw a lot of trumpet players and trombone players and saxophone players and got them together. And, you know, there was Claude Thornhill, Sam Donahue, Conrad Gazzo, Maxi Kaminsky, Frank. It was a hell of a band.
Artie Shaw's Navy Band toured throughout the Pacific war zones, playing on countless islands and warships. Shaw's band returned from the Pacific in November of 1943, and Shaw was honorably discharged soon afterward. He was exhausted, clinically depressed, and in the midst of a divorce. After a period of recovery, he formed a new civilian band in the fall of 1944. It played advanced writing from Ray Conniff, Buster Harding, Jimmy Mundy, and Eddie Salter. And it featured one of the greatest of all jazz trumpeters, Roy Eldridge. Lucky Number, composed and arranged by Ray Conniff, and recorded by Artie Shaw and his orchestra in June of 1945. Burt Carroll.
The band mirrored some of the Shaw past, but it leaned to emerging modern jazz just by the nature of some of the charts and the solo players in the band. And Artie was already starting to change. He said, how could you not respond to people like Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie?
As outstanding as this band was, it did not have hits like those of Shaw's earlier bands, and Shaw disbanded late in 1945. His musical curiosity and virtuosity led him to spend much of the next few years playing and recording classical music.
I just felt it was time to branch off from what people call jazz. It was kind of a boring thing by then. Playing for an audience is not the same as playing in a room like today. Audience in those days were very funny. They wanted to dance. It wasn't called jazz, it was called dance music. We had dance bands. And I got sick of that 4 bars, 8 bars, 12 bars, 16 bars. And I wanted to do something a little looser. And I happened to hear a couple of pieces of music I liked. So I got Hershey Kay, who was a classical arranger, as they call it. I hate that word classical, I hate the word jazz. But anyway, we made some things together. And I decided I would do that for a while to see what it would do to my playing. My entire approach to playing a clarinet changed in a year. I was playing a different instrument.
In 1949, Artie Shaw was back in jazz with yet another big band.
The band loved what was going on in the book, but the hostile world out there, it was hopeless. That was the worst period I've ever been in. The audience loathed that band because we were playing what you might call today a sort of boppish book, and there was no action of oompa, oompa to dance to. They'd make signs of pulling a toilet chain, holding their noses,
and it was horrible. And that has nothing to do with music, has nothing to do with growth, nothing to do with self-development, nothing to do with being interested. It's boring. I couldn't do it.
Clarinetist Dick Johnson.
I think he was playing his best when he had the bebop band with Zoot Sims and Al Cohn and that whole group that he had in 49. As a matter of fact, I saw that band in person. It was one of the most unbelievable things. Johnny Mandel wrote a thing called Innuendo. There was no clarinet player that ever came close to that thing.
Innuendo, composed and arranged by Johnny Mandel, and recorded by Artie Shaw and his orchestra late in 1949. Shaw's superb bebop band lasted only a few months. His last major venture as a player took place in 1954, when he put together a final incarnation of the Gramercy Five, Don Byron.
It doesn't sound like the record somebody would make, the Gramercy Five ones, of somebody who's going to quit. It's almost like suggesting we're going to do some more and it's going to be further out. And then he stops.
Spozen, featuring pianist Hank Jones and guitarist Joe Puma, with Artie Shaw and his Gramercy Five, recorded in June of 1954. By that time, Shaw's frustration with the music business had reached its peak.
The straitjacket was too tight. I couldn't handle the constant need to do the same thing or something similar with the same piece of material.
Soon afterward, Artie Shaw put down his clarinet and never played again.
I had to quit. I saw death approaching if I kept on. No human being can achieve perfection. It got to the point where anything I did wasn't good enough, and I was constantly living in a state of frustration. So I decided I would get out of it, and as a result, I had to get out. So here I am. People say, well, I was my worst enemy. Well, all I know is they're all dead. All of my colleagues are dead. And I'm alive. I must have done something right.
Artie Shaw looking back on his life at the end of 2001. Shaw went on to live 50 years after putting down his clarinet. His music making stopped, but not his restless spirit. In 1955, he moved to the northeast coast of Spain.
I knew I wanted to leave America. I was disillusioned. I'd been hauled up before the Un-American Activities Committee, and a blight hit me. Up till then, I could run the farm. I could go into New York and do game shows. What's My Line and Password, and I was very good at those. So I was making, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 a week doing that. And then suddenly the doors closed. I wrote a story about that in the book called I Love You, Hate You, Drop Dead. Dealt with what a controversial figure was. Television had that nickname for us, controversial figure. So I couldn't appear anymore, and there was no income.
Artie Shaw returned to the United States in 1960 and led a vigorous and varied life. He wrote books starred in movies, conducted seminars, and lectured. In 1983, he surprised the music world by forming his first big band in more than 30 years. Shaw occasionally appeared with this new band in public, but he entrusted most of the leadership of the band and all of his now legendary clarinet solos to Dick Johnson. Artie Shaw's last projects was a 5-CD box set. Shaw considered it a definitive compilation of his best music.
Yeah, I feel it was a good representative collection of what I was doing over a period of time. I gave a quick cursory look over my first bands and took pieces out of that that seemed to represent it. And the others were, some of them recorded in studios, and others were air checks. They were the same arrangements, but done differently. So I feel good about it.
Artie Shaw was a phenomenon, a man who made a huge contribution to American music as a virtuoso clarinetist and as an innovative bandleader. Vigorous till the end, he died in December 2004, just after being named an NEA Jazz Master. Kenny DeVer.
He was compelling. I mean, the way he played was compelling. He knew it. I mean, it came through in his playing. I mean, stand up that fearlessly in front of a band and break the color barrier and stuff like that, you know, in its own way, for its own time. So you got to give him A for effort.
Don Byron.
You know, if a cat is taking risks at a moment, years later, you can still hear the edge in it. And that's the feeling you get with Artie. And I think that's probably why he made such an impression on people that are much more modern than he's supposed to be. It's not like he's less modern. You know, if you're taking risks, you sound hip.
Richard Sudhalter.
I think that I have to agree when he says that playing the clarinet was only one manifestation of an overall thirst, a hunger to learn about the world.
Our original program on the late NEA Jazzmaster Artie Shaw was written and produced by Bill Kirshner. This program is produced by Surreal Muhammad. Special thanks to Tim Owens, Bruce Talbot, Marion McPartland, and the staff at NPR's Piano Jazz. Our technical director is Neil Tivolt, with engineering help from Shireen Strasberg and Chuck Thompson. NPR's director of music is Benjamin Rowe.
You have to look at the world and say, this is the world I got to live in. It's not going to get much better unless I can help make it a little better. I have a form of religion, which is almost a mantra. Leave the world a little better than it was when you came in. Make it a little better. Do what you can to add something to it. I think I've managed to do that to the degree that one person can do it.
I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is Jazz Profiles from NPR, National Public Radio.